and feel in your heart center the divine presence. It is a glowing force that radiates throughout your entire being. When we have our mind focused upon this world only, we lose connection. But the heart is the receiving station. And by attuning yourself to the heart, you feel those divine radiations coming out to you. And you realize that you are not separate from them. They are very close. They are very intimate. There's such a deep part of you that we can oftentimes not see it, not hear it, not feel it. So in this time in particular, attune your station, like a radio, to the divine station, to the divine broadcaster, who is ever wishing you well, who is ever sending you comfort and joy, love and bliss. Realize that you are inheritors of this vast kingdom. And yet so many of us live like paupers, not impoverished in money perhaps, but impoverished in spirit, which is a greater poverty. Feel there the vast riches of your being. Know that you are a son and a daughter of the divine consciousness. You ever have been, you are now, and you ever will be. You need only become conscious of what is also already truth and reality. I'd like to read to you from a transcript of one of Mother's talks. She spoke these words in March of 1975. And she begins, I'd like to read to you tonight from one Swami Ram Dass writings entitled Divine Voice and Guidance. And Papa's writing, Inner voice speaks in the devotee when he has surrendered up his body, mind, and soul into the keeping of the divine who dwells within him. In this state of surrender, this body becomes the willing instrument. The mind is enlightened with divine radiance, and the soul unites and identifies with the Supreme Spirit. Now, God's guidance is felt at every step, and the devotee's life becomes a spontaneous expression of divinity in all its modes of activities. His consciousness becomes one with the universal consciousness, and he transcends the limitations of time and space. His vision becomes all-inclusive and all-embracing. The petty distinctions which held him sway in his early days of ignorance dissolve in the infinite vastness of this exalted spiritual experience. Thus, equality of vision becomes the background of the devotee's life, and his outlook illumines his entire external life. Sometimes, when a devotee who is struggling for a complete surrender confronts a difficult problem and he has to arrive at a definite decision and plan for action, he fails to interpret rightly what God wills him to do. Here, the devotee is sorely puzzled, becomes restless and worried over the solution. This is because the devotee's reasoning faculty, as it were, creating doubt and vacillation, even when the inner voice has spoken and given clear guidance. The ego raises its hood and seeks to confuse his mind. Here, the way out of the difficulty is to adopt an attitude of perfect reliance and resignation to the divine will, and make the mind still and serene, so that the divine spirit may point out emphatically a clear cut line of thought and action. Often, even after a particular decision is reached, according to the command from the divine, should the immediate results prove to be apparently harmful or undesirable, doubt assails the devotee, and he is led to think that his decision is wrong. He then unwisely withdraws or gives up halfway the plan of action upon which he has embarked. He is unable to see his move as willed by the higher power would ultimately produce the most beneficial effect for all concerned. Now the question is, how can one understand whether a certain prompting the devotee gets is either from the divine or from the ego? For there is no external way to test. When the heart of the devotee is in perfect attunement with the divine, and he is surcharged with the peace of the eternal, the voice directs, and there is no mistake. It is the sense of separation from the immortal spirit that prevents the devotee from receiving or recognizing real guidance from him, and hence arises uncertainty and confusion. So, the devotee should live at all times in uninterrupted communion with the resultant surrender to the divine. He should offer himself to God within so thoroughly that by his power and grace the devotee's life is transformed in all its aspects, and his omnipresence and all-controlling power is experienced by him. He should mold, as it were, into the divine pores himself, converting him into his very expression and image. As he has attained divine vision and beholds his own self with a capital S in all and as all, he becomes a powerful force for awakening and guiding humanity to the goal of spiritual liberation and beatitude. His touch and sight acts like magic to reveal the light and peace of the divine in all whom come into contact. Such a one is a rare blessing on earth. He brings unity, goodwill, peace, and harmony on it. Every moment belongs to God. Endeavor to keep your mind dedicated to his feet. God, the ocean of mercy, and this is Mother speaking. Every moment belongs to God. Endeavor to keep your mind dedicated to his feet. God, the ocean of mercy, who has ever blessed the world, pours out his grace at all times. It is incumbent on man to consider everything that happens to be for the best denoting what is most helpful towards the realization of the divine, the realization of the fullness of bliss. Who are truly wealthy? Those who are possessed of the supreme treasure. They alone are really rich and live in abundance. Poor and destitute must be called the man in whose heart the remembrance of God does not abide. To depend solely on him is man's one and only duty. Let his name ever be with you, imperceptibly, relentlessly. Time is creeping away. It is possible to practice God's name under the most adverse circumstances. He causes everything to happen and is, therefore, ever near. In whatever state he keeps anyone at any time, it is all for good. For verily, everything is ordered by him, is of him. Relative happiness, which is happiness depending on anything or anyone, must end in grief. It is man's duty to meditate upon God, who is peace itself. Without having recourse to that which aids the remembrance of God, there can be no peace. Have you not seen what life in this world is? To one to be loved, the one to be loved is God. In him is everything. You must try to find. The Lord is the body. The Lord is the mind. The Lord is all mankind. Serving anyone his service to him only. Endeavor to keep your mind always elevated. Is there ever a time when he is invisible? The discovery of this is all that is wanting. By doing service, heart and mind are purified. Be convinced of this. To engage in service is a very powerful sadhana. Do not become impatient. Rather serve your people with the utmost calm and have a kind word for everyone. Whenever you say or do anything wrong, beg to be forgiven and try your best not to let a similar error occur in the future. Even though others may be unjust to you, you yourself should neither be nor say anything unseemly. The stream of godly thoughts is the path that leads from exhaustion of karma. The stream of godly thoughts is the path that leads to the exhaustion of karma. So long as the goal has not been reached, one is bound to reap the consequences of right action, wrong action, and inaction according to karma, the law of cause and effect. For God may place you at any time and on whatever circumstances, recollect that it is all for the best. Endeavor to go through life, leaving all your burdens in His hands. He is the preserver. He is the guide. He is the all and all. At all times, let forbearance be your norm. Say to yourself, Lord, everything Thou doest is for the highest good. Pray for the power of endurance. Nothing happens that is not an expression of God's grace. Verily, all is His grace. Anchored in patience, enduring everything, abide by His name and live joyously. All this which is His creation is under His dispensation, in His presence and is He. Mother speaking now. That's a tremendous article. We have mentioned from time to time that seeming state of chaos in the world today, the tremendous upheaval. Years ago, there is a master who went into silence. That silence was to last only 1 year. And at the end of the year, he's going to speak a word which would cause a tremendous upheaval in the world, where the forces of good and evil, the Battle of Armageddon, or the Battle of Kurukshetra, would commence to take place. There would be tremendous reaching out of the Spirit for those whose hearts were pure, who wanted great enlightenment, who wanted their oneness with God. And on the other hand, there would be tremendous opposition by the forces which were trying to keep them from reaching their goal, trying to keep everything going away from God. We have but to look around us today to see the manifestation of this. This man, at the end of the year, did not, so-called, break his silence. This man, at the end of the year, did not, so-called, break his silence. He continued on year after year in a so-called mana, which is spelled M-A-U-N-A, always keeping his disciples glued to him. He was a tremendous saint of love. Love was the keynote to everything. He didn't teach them specific lessons. He taught them love, and he kept promising them that one day, when God directed him to, he would break his silence. The God was himself, because he said he was the Savior, so that he was the Ancient One, that he was the Avatar, come in this age to take all unto himself. So year after year went by. The disciples grew in number. They became terrifically glued to the Master, and he told them that all they had to do was to hang on to his daman, or hem of his robe, and he would take them to God. In the meantime, he asked them to serve him and to serve him in everyone they met. And so they did this. And the Master had tremendous power and he had tremendous vision. But through all of this, he didn't keep complete mona or silence, because to do that means to retire within yourself. You see, even the flutter of an eyelash brings with it its corresponding vibration and therefore reaction. So he used his fingers, he used an alphabet board to communicate with his disciples, and finally one of the great women saints in India, in a discussion with me one day, told me with her own lips that he had summoned her to his ashram and that rather than maintain mauna or silence, he had spoken to her and had asked her to leave her guru and come to him. There are many stories told, but the final conclusion, or at least the seeming conclusion of this particular story, is that the master passed on, left his body, without saying that word which would commence the tremendous upheaval, the tremendous reaching out for enlightenment. Someone else spoke that word, and that word was spoken on December 28, 1957. I was there, and immediately the forces were set into action. The individual who spoke the word paid the biggest price of all, but this had to come to be. And great visions had been given at this time, which were as the turn of the cycle when all must go back to God. The vision that came that everything had been going out from God. Now, of course, it returns, but man's consciousness had descended into the age of darkness, the age of Kali Yuga. During that age of darkness, it is said that Jesus Christ came to the earth, and he was born the Son of Man, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And he came, and through his exemplary life, showed us the way in which every man must go if he is to reach his oneness with the divine. This is a tremendous teaching that Mother gives here. And of course, that one who spoke the word was Papa Ramdas. It was on a certain day when Mother was seated in the bhajan hall at the feet of Papa. There were seven sadhus who showed up that day and were also seated around. And suddenly Papa set out a long breath that went right over the top of Mother's head. And this put her into a terrific state of spiritual experiences, the mystical crucifixion. And there is so much that as follows that books and books could not contain at all. Because Mother went through what all humanity, all mankind must go through in its ascent from the human to the divine. But you see, what she went through was so much more than what any of us would have to go through, because she went through it not for herself, but for all mankind. She was told by different saints and different ones, including her own guru, that she had a special incarnation and that she did not come into this world with any karma of her own. That is, she is herself an avatar. And she couldn't even believe it at the time, because she felt she was just this one tiny woman who was born into this world. And who was she? She always felt that she was the least of any. On one of her journeys, she met with a tremendous God woman, Elizabeth Hite. And during that meeting, she had in her conversation with Elizabeth, Elizabeth was going on and talking about the autobiography of the yogi and master, and saying that it was filled with ego and it was just all I. And Mother would say normally she would immediately go to battle for master. But in this case, she said, well, I have read your book recently, Initiation. And in that, I saw the word I all the way through. Elizabeth Hite said, yes, but that was of a previous incarnation. And Mother said, nevertheless, it is about your soul, yourself, and your own evolution. And suddenly Elizabeth Hite, I don't think she's used to anybody standing up to her. She's a big, powerful woman. And she looked at Mother, and she looked at her very intently for a little while. And then she said, why do you go around thinking that you're the littlest one? You're greater than any saint that you have met or any saint you will ever meet. Why do you not stand up straight and say, I am that I am? In telling this, Mother said, it was later on when she had returned back to America. She was in Switzerland at the time and went on to India. When she returned home, Suddenly those words came back to her, and she stood up and she said, "I am that I am." And she had a tremendous experience that came from that. It's very interesting how a soul who is completely God-realized has to keep on a layer of ignorance in order to operate into this world. Unlike those of us who have karma, and therefore do not have the freedom to release ourselves, a true master will take on a persona, and that persona will have all the opposites contained in it. And even though they are master of themselves, they will take on apparent delusion of some sort or another, because that's what it takes to be able to operate in this world. It may sound like a strange thing, but it's true. If you think about an actor who's going to be in a play or a movie, they are assigned a role and given a script, and they have a character that they play while they're there. But they know somewhere deep down in their soul, even if they're a method actor and they're totally into their role, they know that at the end of the day, that they are themselves an actor playing a role. Most of us do not realize that we are actors playing a role. We think of it as ourselves. This is me. This is my life. And we don't like it to be marginalized as we would think about it if it was just a role. And yet, to realize that this is just a role that we play, that this is not who we truly are, this name that I was given, or perhaps one that I adopt along the way, is not who I am. My profession is not who I am. My social circle, my families, is not who I truly am. These are temporary things, the things that come and they go. To realize who I really am, I have to go deep. That is, I have to go beyond all of these assumed roles. And I have been assuming roles for so long through so many incarnations, it doesn't just go away in a day. If I had the most tremendous concentration, I would be able to do so. That is what Sri Yukteswar assures us. But most of us are mixed in our motives. We want to realize, we want the bliss of God, we want to be uplifted, we want to know the truth. Therefore, we want wisdom. We want all of these things, and yet we want all of these things and to preserve the ego all at the same time. We want the world to think well of us. We want to have a positive influence on this world. We want, I want, it's all I. But it is a false notion of I. Because embedded in every desire by the I of the ego is a hook, like you would hook a worm onto a hook to catch a fish. The ego is casting about, and it wants these various things, but it wants to satisfy itself, not God. And even if we go to church and we do not challenge the ego, then it is just simply a spiritual extension of the ego. It's a pseudo-spiritual self. Oh, this is what a spiritual person does. And then you act like that. But it is an act. It doesn't come from the real center, the real core of your being. To have that, you must go beyond all things of the little I and enter into the great magnificence of the divine I, the divine ego. The I am that I am. That is what is said is the true name of God. And it is the I am of your great being. It is the I am that transcends all other ego considerations. You can only know this by going beyond the mind. And that is the last bastion, oftentimes, of the ego. We have so many temptations, we have so many things that draw us away from that prime simplicity of our oneness with God. It really is simple. It really is the most basic part of our nature. And yet the ego makes it so complicated. It tries to insert itself into every aspect of our sadhana, of our spiritual path. I remember one Christmas and honoring Mother's birthday when I was at Anandashram. And I had noticed that at the ashram they had this cassette player with speakers. It was a boombox type thing, and it had stopped functioning, and they used it every day. So I had, when I was going to another town, I had been asked to look in on this young man who was mentally ill, and his parents not knowing what to do with him had chained him to the wall. So he had this large chain that was anchored in the wall and then went around his waist, and there was a padlock on it. And so that's where he lived all the time. So I was working to get him some services so that he could be released from this condition and perhaps be given some help. So I was traveling to a nearby city in order to do this. And when I was there, I had bought this large boombox that I thought would serve their purposes very well. And I thought I would give it to them on Christmas Day. They don't celebrate Christmas. They don't celebrate any of the Hindu holidays either. So it's just another day. And every night I would go in and I would sit with Swamiji. And he would be working with those that were close to him, and they would be discussing letters and discussing the business of the ashram. And I just simply started showing up and sit and meditate. And one day somebody told me, oh, you're not supposed to go in at that time. And it wasn't anybody there. It was somebody, a devotee at the ashram. So I wondered about it, but they never threw me out. And I thought, well, as long as they don't throw me out, I'll just keep coming. And one night when I was sick and I didn't go, and I went the next night, and Swamiji said, oh, you didn't come last night. I said, no, I've been ill, but I took that as permission that it was all right to come. So I showed up that night with this boombox, and I had been quite excited. I'd been keeping it under my bed, under wraps, ready to give it to them at the special moment. And this was the only night that Swamiji was not available. And I went to the door, and the door was closed, which was highly unusual. I knocked on the door. Somebody came and said, oh, they were having a meeting with the board of directors, and Swamiji would not be available that night. So I was a little dejected, but soon Swamiji appeared at the door, and I presented it to him, and I had some excitement about it, and he said, oh, that's nice, and he sat it down, and he turned around and went back into the meeting. I was a bit disappointed by the whole thing. I had hoped that it would be a special occasion, not just the gift giving, but the honoring of Mother, that it was Mother's birthday, that it was Christmas, that it was some celebration of both of those things. And so you see, there's a little bit of ego in there that was edging itself in. It was attached to it looking like a certain thing instead of just doing it because God was prompting me to do it. I was looking for some result. I was looking for some outcome. So God arranged it so that it worked out perfectly, that I didn't have that moment. I remember there was a wonderful, beautiful young woman who came, a magnificent artist, and she brought in a picture of Papa Ramdas that she'd been working on. And I looked at it, and it was just wonderful. It ended up in the Bhajan hall, and it looks like Papa's sitting there, and he's actually sitting there. It's so realistic. And so she presented it. And all Swamiji did is he nodded toward her, and that was it. That was his approval of the picture, and that's all she got from it. And I thought, that'd be a tough test. She'd been working on this art all this time. Finally, she was presenting it to him, and what she got was a slight nod. As I got to know Swamiji and the ashramites better, I realized that this was wonderful for her that she got as much from that as anybody else if they made a great fuss about it. Just that simple nod and acknowledgement that it was now acceptable, it was now correct. If you think of living your entire life and doing it in such a way that God is well pleased, and you rise up out of your body on that day when you leave it, and you go to the feet of God, and He looks at you, and for Him to give you a simple nod of His head is a life well lived. It was a life well done. Would that not mean everything for you? When we let go of the ego, when we enter into that silence, then the guidance of God comes to us. And when it comes in a still, small voice. Now, sometimes you hear it as a literal voice. Sometimes it comes to you as a very soft whisper. But as you honor that and you act on it, let us just say for the moment, it's the highest light that you know in the moment. You don't know whether it is your own ego, you don't know whether it is God directing you, you simply know it's the highest light that you know, and you've worked at it. It's not that you've just thrown it on God and then the first thought that comes to you, you take. Rather, you've really meditated about it. You've really given it at the feet of God. And then suddenly an idea comes to you. Now, you act on that idea. You don't hesitate. You take it as God's direction. But it doesn't just end there. You keep thinking about God. Is this the right thing? You keep attuning yourself to Him. You keep presenting it to Him, especially if there's any doubt in your mind whatsoever. And as long as it presents itself as the highest light that you know, and you continue to act on it, even if it turns out supposedly wrong, you will still have gain spiritually. Because you are acting in good faith according to the highest light that you know. And this will help to purify your mind. And even if you get it wrong, God will arrange for you, because you are sincere in your search, to purify you so that you will learn the lesson from where you went wrong. And you will do it better next time. You will know better. As you continue to attune yourself, you feel God's guidance. It's been many years since I've ridden horses. But when I did, there were horses that were known to have soft mouth and those that had hard mouth. And a soft mouth, all you had to do was give the slightest, tenderest tug on the reins, and the horse would go in that direction. Somebody with a hard mouth, you could do that, they would just keep going the same way that they wanted to do. Remember when I was young and we were riding right next to the irrigation ditch, and it's about 10 feet of water, and this horse just absolutely insisted to walk right on the edge. And I kept on seeing us go completely over and into this water, and who knows what would happen if that happened. So I kept trying to pull him off to the side and into the trail, but he just wanted to go his own way. And with these kind of horses, you have to really pull on the rein. You have to assert yourself. And so it is with God, that He guides us, for us to have a soft mouth with Him. If He just tugs, if He just taps on the reins, that we're immediately attuned to Him. We're desirous to do what He wants us to do, not what we want to do. We can be so filled with our own wants, how can we ever know what it is that God wants us to do? But through our sincere and deepened meditation, through our conscious attunement with Him, He will make His will known in us. By taking that inner guidance and acting upon it, whether it's what we want or not, oftentimes it goes against what we want in the moment. but it's what he wants. And every time you act on it, you see that it works out better. It's better because it's divine will, not the will of your own ego. Sometimes you think, I know God wants me to get this done. This happens to me often. And yet it doesn't happen. He doesn't give the go-ahead. You know that it will get fulfilled. But the moment's not right. This is not excuse-making. This is God's will in action. And then he wills it. And then it all goes full speed ahead. And you know that you're acting in accordance with his will. And this is the most tremendous state to be in. Because you are now an instrument to divine will. Every thought, every emotion, everything is tuned to that divine consciousness. And God will use you. Krishna told Arjuna that if he is in this state of surrender and things don't work out well from a human standpoint, it's still perfect spiritually. Master one time said, if the whole world disagreed with him, and yet God was telling him to do a certain thing, he would do it. He would not hesitate. And you really have to think about that. If the whole world disagreed with you, that's a tough one. It's all right when we live in an echo chamber and live around people who voice the same ideas that we have, want the same things we want. What's the difficulty? What's the challenge in that? But if the whole world disagreed with you, that's a tough one, isn't it? And yet Master said it, and I know he meant it. He would do exactly as God directed him to do. He was known when he was a young man as the Mad Monk. You know that moniker may not have always been meant kindly. There may have been some derision in it. So you have to be willing to go against the people who are around you when God is telling you to do a certain thing. This is the most wonderful life, but you have to be willing to surrender everything in order to be able to live it. If you hold on to even one strand of the ego, it'll trip you up. When you let go completely, surrender totally, are willing to do anything and everything that God directs you to do, then you become his instrument. And there is no greater life than that. One time Swamiji had given me the statue of Ganesha. It's a wooden car statue. And he is very sweet, and he said, you know, he was telling me about a Ganesh statue that's famous in India because it drinks milk. They hold milk up to its trunk, and somehow it drinks the milk out of its trunk. So he said, I wonder if this one will drink milk. And so, you know, he was in the process of giving it to me, and he asked one of the attendants, and they went off, and they got some milk, and they got a spoon. And Swami, in a just very childlike kind of way, he just takes the glass and takes the milk and holds it up to the trunk. And he holds it up to there for a few minutes, some time. No milk disappeared. And Swamiji said, oh, I guess he's not thirsty today. So simple, so childlike. One time he announced, this is before I went to the ashram or knew him, that he felt he was going to leave on a certain day. He was going to die, leave the body. And so everybody was in quite a state of consternation around this. And the day finally arrived. It had been announced some months beforehand, and the day finally arrived. And they go through the whole day, and everybody's waiting on pins and needles, waiting to see what's going to come off here. Is he going to leave that body the day? And it finally got to be midnight, and there were those who were around him, and Swamiji said, well, I guess it's not going to happen today. So he had this complete childlike trust. Now, perhaps God gave it to him to announce this and to create this stir, maybe to sharpen people's focus. Oh, what would we do if Swamiji were no longer here? And they would sharpen their focus on attaining their own God realization. It would wake them up out of their stupor. It's not something that you can plan to do with your ego. It doesn't work like that. But when God prompts it, he's got a reason for it. And so he may put you into a position that is humbling or even humiliating. Look at the life of Jesus and the times when he was ridiculed, times when they even wanted to stone him and to kill him. And yet he was able to keep that childlike innocence and openness and willingness to serve God, no matter what would happen. God prompted him to say, if you destroy this temple, I will rebuild it in 3 days, meaning this body. But they didn't know how to take it, so they thought of this immense temple that had taken decades to build. And they ridiculed him for it. But he didn't mind, because he was serving his heavenly Father. That's what mattered to him. When we are able to put aside all of the considerations of this world, to be simple, childlike, to hold ourselves in that state, and never mind what the rest of the world thinks or does or says about what we do, as long as we know that we are right with God, then that's the only thing that matters. And if we don't know, then going deep into meditation in order to find that out. Am I right with you? And oftentimes all we have to do is ask the question. Immediately we'll know if there are any places in our life that were out of alignment, out of attunement with God. He will let us. He will guide us. And it's not just the ego feeling bad about itself. It's the wisdom of discrimination. And so you go to work on those things. You change those things. You don't just let them go by. You make your life count. When you do this, you live fully, completely, both on the human and the divine levels of consciousness. And as I said before, it is the most tremendous life. It holds the greatest promise. And whatever it asks of you in a human sense, it is more than worth it in what you receive in spiritual wealth, gifts, and abundance. For God will load your being with his light, with his bliss, with his joy, with his love, with his wisdom, to the point where it is overflowing. You cannot literally hold it all for yourself. It must go out into this world. So let us begin now, this very day. Once there was a devotee of masters who was telling me about St. Francis. This was very early on in my spiritual sadhana. And he said, this is what St. Francis is like. If he heard about Master tonight, he'd start walking to California right now. He's like that. Of course, Master had long left the body by that time. But that was the sense of immediacy that he had about St. Francis. So intent, so dedicated, so focused. And look at how St. Francis has benefited this world so beautifully, so wonderfully. He is an icon held out everywhere, whether people are really willing to follow his life or not. It's another thing. But he is an icon for love. Love of God and nature, love of God, surrender, dedication. He had it all. So let us look at these great masters, emulate them in their desire to know and to serve God, and we will receive spiritual wealth that will be beyond imagination, anything that we can conceive of today. With those words, I pranam and bow to the light within you. Send you my love, my blessings, and that you may ever aspire to serve and to love God so completely that you merge yourself into his being and become one with him. Om, amen. So lovely to have this time with you tonight.